Love Osho podcast brings you the real stories of the people whose lives have been inspired and transformed by Osho. We explore why thousands of people are falling in love with Osho and where to find them. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the Love Osho podcast. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Ma Prem Jalada. Jalada took sannyas in 1977 and lived with Osho since then in all the three communes. In Pune too, Jalada worked in the library in Lao Tzu, preparing the clipboard with the questions and jokes used by Osho in his discourses. Jalada, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hello, Swaram. I'm fine. Right now, I'm very happy to connect with you.
Okay, great. So, to start, tell us a little bit about how you came across Osho.
There were two events. One was my own near-death experience, which was very blissful. But there was some heavy, heavy fallout from that, which was a bit of a hell. And then later on, my sister, who was very close to me, we were 18 months apart, she died suddenly. And these two events kind of really pushed me on the path. I didn't even know I was on the spiritual path until then. But I was interested in reading classics like Autobiography of a Yogi or Be Here Now. I was reading Krishnamurti and I didn't even understand it, except that I knew it was good. Since there was no internet, I lived way out in the countryside in the Pacific Northwest, so getting books was difficult. But it really started the day after my sister's funeral. I flew to Boston to do a three-day psychotherapy group. And at the end of the first day, a man who was also attending the group asked me if I needed a place to stay because he saw my suitcase sitting at reception. And I said, yeah, I didn't have a hotel booked or anything. So he took me to this house where he lived, and there were some other very beautiful people lived there. I didn't really get to meet them. I would see them coming and going. So as it turned out, after the group was over, I tried to book a flight home. Everything was booked up. I had to wait 2 weeks, at least 2 weeks in Boston. I got to know the people a little bit and went back to Washington State where I lived, and my whole life turned around. After a few months, I returned to Boston, moved into that same house. And this is where I had connected with someone I met when I had stayed there during the group and started a new relationship. I found work in Harvard Square. And I only knew that a couple of people living in the house had a guru in India, but nothing more than that. But that changed pretty quickly because soon after moving in, a sannyasin named Harideva had just arrived from India from the ashram. His arms were loaded with Osho books and newsletters from the ashram. And he came in and laid them on the kitchen table. I think he was bringing them to a local Osho center. And he saw that I was looking at these books and newsletters, and he said, take a newsletter here, have one. So I took it. It was a transcript of the morning discourse. And as I read the printed words, they just kind of leapt out of the page. And I experienced something I had never felt before. It was totally new. It was a transmission. And just for a moment, my mind just was stunned. It wasn't so much the words I was reading or understanding. It was just the energy. And it was the first time in my life I felt I'm encountering truth. And this was a new experience for me. Those words had truth, but they had this power, a love behind them. And instantly, I was in love. It was really that simple. I just felt that I was being pulled by this invisible force that I trusted completely. And I remember years later hearing people say that we sannyasins were brainwashed and in a cult. And I used to laugh because at that moment, reading his words and coming into contact with Osho for the first time, I didn't feel brainwashed, nor did I go nuts. I felt more sane than ever. And it was more like a feeling my ears popped, my vision changed. Something in me woke up. So I carry this newsletter with me to work every day, reading it again and again in my breaks. And from that time, I just started saving my money. And a few months later, in August of 1977, I flew to Pune with $200 and my one suitcase.
Okay, so I think the idea that being with Osho means to be brainwashed is one of the biggest misunderstandings around Osho. And anyway, we can discuss perhaps this later on. But for now, I'd love to stay with this powerful experience you had just by reading few words of Osho, and your world turned around, and then the pull was so strong that you decided to go to India with just $200. So yeah, tell us from that moment how then you took sannyas, how you came to Osho.
So I landed in Bombay. I took a taxi to the ashram. I went to my first discourse. And that's, I think, where I really first met Osho. At the end of the morning discourse, he would stand a namaste to every one of us sitting before he left the hall. And he would stand and turn very slowly and look out at all of us. And when he looked in my direction, he looked right at me. Our eyes met. And I know that's impossible almost, because it was a big hall. I wasn't sitting up close. But that's how I remember it. And now I see that's how it is around Osho. It was truly magical. So at that moment that our eyes met, my mind and my body, it just kind of collapsed. It just let go. I was sitting, so I kind of fell over sideways. But I remember that at the very last moment, I put my elbow out or my arm, and it kept me from my head hitting the cement floor of Buddha Hall. So for me, that was our first meeting. I was not prepared at all for the power of being in his presence. It was similar when I took sannyas, only I didn't fall over. I just closed my eyes as we were waiting for Osho to enter Chuang-Tzu Auditorium. And I just closed my eyes for a moment. And the next thing I know, I hear Osho speaking to someone. And I open my eyes and I nearly panicked, because I thought, oh no, maybe they called my name and I missed. But I didn't, of course. And darshan happened beautifully.
Okay, wonderful. And I believe that you have been with Osho pretty much since then, all the time. You never really left, and you had a long-term experience living in the communes. So during all this time, have you had any personal advice or guidance from Osho? Have you asked him any personal questions?
Not very much. Usually it was by letter, and sometimes, mostly he just said, follow your own feelings. One time he told me to sit every day for an hour, do sit quietly, and then come see him in darshan. But nothing specific that I can say right now. I used to go to darshan every month, because you were allowed to do that, or even more, I think. And he would call you up, but mostly not to speak, but to do energy work on other people. So he would just call me to help.
Are you saying that you were one of the mediums during the darshan energies?
No, but before the medium started, he used to just pull women out of the group of people sitting in darshan. And because I used to, waiting to go into darshan, you sat on these wooden benches on the driveway outside the house. And when it was time to go in, I would race to the front so I could get a front seat, because I'm small. And if I sat at the back, I couldn't see Osho. And so I used to race to the front and sit in the front row somewhere, even on the very end, or the second row was fine too. But also that way he could see you. So when he called you up, you could make sure it was you he was calling and not somebody else that was so far away. Do you know what I mean, Swara?
Absolutely. I mean, in a way, no, because I'm very tall, so I'm usually the guy at the very back.
Yeah,
but I totally anyway, appreciate that.
No, I was. I, he, I was never a medium, no. Except, you know, just spontaneous before the medium thing started. But once it started, the same women went every night. I was called in twice to be a medium during that time, but not regularly, no.
Oh, wow. Well, that must have been a very, very powerful, intense experience. You know, I can only look at those images and there are some videos and it's wow.
Yeah, it was amazing. Overpowering. It was really just slayed your mind, you know.
Okay, so you live with Osho in all the three communes. Living in a commune dedicated to spiritual awakening in the presence of an enlightened master and with thousands of seekers is an incredible experience. So how was for you this experience? Tell us a little bit about what are the most significant things that happened to you during this time in the three communes.
Oh my goodness, that's a big question. I want to mention that a friend in Pune was translating very early Hindu discourses from Osho into English. And I met him one day. This was in Pune too, after Osho left his body. And he told me in this translation that Osho had said in the future he would have three communes. And the first commune he called the commune of sex. The second commune was the commune of power. And the third was the commune of death. He told me this, but it took me a while to really look back and reflect that it fit perfectly my own experience. Pune 1 was really the Tantra vision. It was about surrender, letting go, allowing, not repressing anything. So we lived a very natural, beautiful, celebrative life. It was really, really difficult to explain, except that I felt like I lived in a paradise. At the end of Pune 1, I felt the energy began to shift a little bit. I knew Osho was leaving. So the next Rajneeshpuram, when I arrived at the ranch, it was so beautiful too, because Osho was living there. But a very different energy in the sense that it felt more masculine. And I liked that too. It was a contrast to Pune 1. It felt a little like the honeymoon was over. We didn't see Osho as much except for drive-by. And that was our one chance to have a glimpse of him. So Rajneeshpuram, the commune of power, well, that to me is so obvious that that was the case. There was no way to avoid it. And there was so much in myself that was unprocessed, that was unseen. And it was easy for me to be hooked into a victim story. It was easier for me to fight than to look at myself. So I avoided that for as long as I could. But it reminds me now of something I heard from Byron Katie when she said, defense is the first act of war. And I was always ready to defend myself when I felt that I was being judged or accused or whatever the story was. The lesson of power was very clear, not only with one's personal experience with power, but the United States versus Rajneeshpuram, as it was laid out in Wild Wild Country. I wasn't tuned into what was actually happening on the criminal end of things. But I could certainly feel, as many did, that not everything was squeaky clean around the people in charge. But the majority of us, from what I could tell, wanted no part of this drama and criminality. And we just wanted to be with our master and be left in peace.
What it's interesting for me, just as a feedback, I feel like all the people who had the experience of living in Pune 1, they carry something slightly different from the people who arrived later and never had that chance to be with Osho in Pune 1. The guys who are in Pune 1, they have a different type of bond. There is something that is more into the heart chakra, maybe, I don't know.
Yes, the bond with the people in Pune 1 is... It's so difficult to explain. For me, it was because it was my entry into Osho's world. was Puna One. So it was all first experiences, walking into the ashram for the first time, meeting people for the first time, working in an ashram in the commune, going to discourse every morning. Every single morning you could go and sit with him. It was amazing. And it was just new and fresh. And we were so young and totally, totally in love with Osho and everybody. We were all in love with each other, I think.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, that's probably the reason why it transpires and it's so strong and so clear. Even today, after so many years, that experience was so powerful in the loving way. It was the power of love, literally.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's move on to Puna 2. I'd love to hear a little bit about what changed again in Puna 2, the different environment, atmosphere, dynamics, and energy there. And also, I understand that you had a little job in Puna 2, which I think is very interesting, preparing Osho's discourse materials. And I really want to know what that means and what did you have to do?
Okay. Most of the time in Puna 2, I worked in Lao Tzu House, but my first job was to help set up the boutique. It was still the beginning of Puna 2. The ashram was going through all kinds of renovations inside the existing buildings, outside the buildings. The gardens were being planted and the pathways were being created. So the morning that the boutique was going to open for the first time, Lao Tzu Manisha, not to be confused with dancing Manisha, came by and asked if I could help her with her work, starting right now. So I had no idea why she thought of me. I never asked. I didn't know her personally, but she was given the task by Bhagwan to write a book, which would take up most of her time. If you remember, Manisha was the one of the main editors, and it was her voice that asked Osho the questions and read the sutras during Puna 2. And if Osho had notes or jokes, she prepared them for him and put them on a small clipboard. So she wanted me to take over the preparation of Osho's clipboard while she wrote her book. And she showed me what to do, and she would check all my work every day. She was still responsible. She was my coordinator. So in the beginning of Puna 2, Osho was taking questions for discourse, and I would pick up these questions from a wooden box near the front gate of the ashram. People would drop them in for evening discourse, and they were all handwritten, sometimes difficult to read. So I would collect them, type them up, and I would take them to Manisha with the original handwritten questions, check them, and send them in to Osho. So Manisha was living in Lao Tzu, working in her bedroom. So I would go there, and I would work at a table in the library, mostly in the library. So I would type up these questions in a large print, because Osho's eyes were affected by the poisoning, so he needed very large print in order to read easily. So I would print them in large print and put them in a folder, and those would go into him. But I also had to find jokes to submit along with the questions, which was a pretty big task, actually. And I needed to find about 15 new jokes every day, type them up, submit them with the questions, and then Osho would choose which ones he liked. And the rest were discarded, and I couldn't resubmit them again. So it was a big task finding those jokes. And he had joke books in his library. So I started with that. And when I ran out of joke books, I put out a call to sannyasins anywhere in the world to please send jokes for Bhagwan. So all this time, I was working at a table with a small electric typewriter, and later on I had a computer and a laser printer, so I could type up the print in large print on heavy cardstock paper that turned out to be much more beautiful and clean and, of course, in large print. And these cards would fit neatly into a small hardcover folder that Osho would use in discourse. Later on, he wanted to speak on Zen, so I needed to find books in the library on Zen teachers, like ancient Chinese, Japanese, Dogen, whatever I could find in his own library. So I would have to speed read the book very quickly and then make selections from the beginning, the middle, and the end of the book, and then try and figure out how much material there was for Osho to use for a book's worth. So I'm not sure, but I think it would be like a month's worth of discourses. So I would type up a synopsis of the book, a short description, who the teacher was, like, I don't know, Rinzai or whoever. And I would type up the title, the author, a synopsis, selections that I thought Osho might want to use, stick them in the book, and submit the book to him through Vivek, Nirvana, or Chetna. Sometimes Chetna would take them in, and he would look at the material and decide whether he would use it or not. And if he did, then he would make the selections from what I submitted. I would then again type them up and resubmit them to him. He still wanted jokes at times, so that was on top of it. So it was a lot, and I loved it. I got moved around Lao Tzu House a lot because there was so much construction going on. So I worked alone at a table all day, except when I went to see Manisha to check everything that I typed and the editing was right and correct. And when I worked in the main room of the library, it was lovely because Kavisho was the librarian and there was a lot of laughter. In the beginning, they were still unpacking Osho's books, putting them on the shelves. And it was lovely. We rarely had any visitors in there, but once in a while, Anubhuta, who was Osho's body worker, he sometimes stuck his head in to say hello when he passed by in the hallway. And it was beautiful.
I can feel like for you connecting to those moments, to those memories, it's evocating that beautiful energy of laughter and love, and can, you know, picture you laughing with Kavisho and chuckling with Anubhuta, and we interview them both. So for anyone interested, so it's beautiful also to put together this puzzle of all the different sannyasins living there. And everyone with their own point of views and stories, but somehow there are points of contact. So now is the library, and you did your part, Kavisho did her part, and Anubhuta did his part. So wonderful. And for me, it's fascinating to hear about the jokes, that you had to send a lot of jokes. Osho would select few and then discharge completely everything else. And then the next day you had to find completely new jokes. And I've got a question which you might not know because no one knows, but perhaps you had a chance to discuss this with Manisha or other sannyasins. It's about how Osho went about choosing the questions. And of course, during a discourse, he would perhaps answer one or two or three, and the other questions were answered another day or not answered at all. So what's your take on that? How would Osho choose the question?
Oh, I have absolutely no idea. Absolutely none. It is not predictable. Not at all. I'm sorry. I have no way to know.
Mm-mm. Now, I can imagine that. And it's one of those mysterious things that will stay in the mystery of of the story. Okay. Yeah. So, well, thank you so much for this beautiful energy that you recreated going back to the time of the commune and the different aspects, completely different experiences from Pune 1 to Rajinshpuram and Pune 2. And now, coming closer to your present day life, I am aware that you are cooking new ideas and there is an exciting new project coming up in the pipeline for you. So I'd love you to discuss and tell us a little bit about what's happening.
Actually, I've kind of dropped it because of the pandemic, Swaram, because it just seems the wrong time. Just before the pandemic, I had a very strong feeling that I wanted to live again with sannyasins and fellow travelers. And it could be a small group of people, two or three, or it could be something bigger. But I felt it was really time. It was urgent. So I wanted to write something up and submit it to Osho News, maybe Osho Viha, if they were okay, and call out to everyone, everywhere, that wants to live once again together before it's too late. And we're getting older and we need to support each other. And I don't know about anyone else, but I don't want to live in an old folks home. I want to live with fellow travelers and live in love. And so that was the basic idea. And I was going to just give my email address. I have Facebook, but I'm hopeless at Facebook and I've dropped it. So I'm not using that.
I think that Manisha, whom you mentioned before and whom you work with, she had a similar idea. And I think she's doing something with that. It's more related to when people are dying. She has created a sort of community for people who are dying and she's facilitating this process. So it's not exactly what you're saying, but it's somehow on the same line. And then more recently, there is another project from Majid in Italy, and they are trying to materialize a commune for people, mainly sannyasins, to live together. And of course, most of the sannyasins who are taking up this, getting involved with the project are people like you, like a little bit older sannyasins who, again, don't want to be on their own in the later stage of their life after having experienced the beautiful life with Osho in the commune. So, yeah, perhaps, I don't know if you want to, you know, link up with those existing projects or perhaps, do something in the USA. It would be beautiful.
Well, I have to be in the USA because I'm only legal here. And after years of living with doing turnarounds, getting visas, I can't do that anymore. So I want to find somewhere here, probably Hawaii, maybe, you know, the Northwest, far Northwest, away from California where there's too many fires.
Okay, so how do you envision this place? Because, of course, you know, you had the experience of living in three different types of communities. So how do you see this place and the people living together there happening?
I find it coming to me more as living independently, but together. There was a lot of sharing rooms, lack of privacy, which was fine in the ashram and in Russian Shipuram. But now, no, I want to have my own room, my own bathroom, and we can share a kitchen. And if we need to hire someone to keep it clean, we can do that and share that expense. But I think many of the sannyasins that I've met and am connected with now that we're older, we really value our privacy. We need a lot of alone time, downtime, quiet time. The vision is to live together harmoniously in love and no cleanup rotas and scheduling of these chores and those kind of things. No, it has to be very grown up and taking responsibility.
Okay, well, that's a very beautiful vision, and it's independent but also sharing, so the best of the two worlds. And in fact, just to finish on this, it's similar in principle to what Majid is promoting for the commune in Italy, because that project is called Alone and Together, or Together and Alone, something like that. So it has a similar vision of
that's a beautiful name. Yes, Alone and Together is beautiful.
Okay, so we are heading towards the end. And before I ask you three final questions, is there anything else you would like to add?
Yes, there's one last thing, Swaram, about working in the library. I was still working in Lao Tzu, typing, and I was preparing something for Osho that needed to get finished before he came out again. He had been ill and hadn't come out for a day or two. And I had a lot of work to do. So I got permission to access the library veranda where I could work without having to go through Lao Tzu House. Because it was before normal working hours. It was early morning. The library was locked. So I got permission. It was fine. So I walked down to the driveway by Lao Tzu House. And the veranda ran the whole length of the main part of the library along the side of the driveway. So I could just hop over the low railing that was there. And there I had a table and a typewriter. So there were these French doors that were locked that would open out into the veranda. And I was sitting typing one morning and I kept turning and looking at these French doors behind me for no reason. But for some reason, my energy was drawn there. And I kept looking at these doors. And then I'd go back and type for another few minutes and I kept looking at the doors. Then I went back to typing again. And then I heard the doors open and I heard Nirvana's voice and I heard her say, oh, like she was a bit surprised to find me sitting there. And as I turned my head, I felt that someone was standing next to me. And as I looked down, I immediately recognized Osho's feet and his shoes, his sandals. And I thought, oh, there's only one person that wears those sandals. And I looked up and he was just standing right next to me. And I just looked up at him and he smiled and indicated I should just go on with whatever I'm doing. And but I knew that was impossible. I was pinned in for one thing. He was standing so close to me, I couldn't move. Nirvana was standing on the other side. And so I just sat and listened to him give Nirvana instructions about how he wanted the renovation of the veranda to be extended into the main library, out into the veranda. So shelves would be put in here, put a shelf over there, make sure that it has the glass in the front, and gave very detailed directions. And he would point to all the places he was talking about. And so I would just look up at Osho and listen to what he was saying, and then he would point somewhere on the wall, and then Nirvana and I would both look at where he was pointing. And that just went on for a while, and then I just felt to close my eyes for a little bit. So I just sat and closed my eyes, and instantly, almost immediately, I felt this waterfall of bliss just pouring over my head and over my body. It was like, if I could see it, they were like very, very tiny pinpricks of light just pouring over me. It was blissful. And then I heard Nirvana's voice, so I came back and I looked up at Osho and he was smiling at me, beaming. Nirvana was telling Osho my name, who I was. He was probably wondering what I was doing. And he was wearing a beautiful blue robe, very simple, and a simple plain hat. And his every movement was just so him, so beautiful, so powerful. And at the same time, he was so ordinary that it just felt so natural just to be sitting there, just hanging out. It just felt so normal. So that was always amazing with Osho, that there were the two sides, the power of his presence that would just slay your mind. And at the same time, he was so ordinary. It was extraordinary because who do you meet that's ordinary? Who escapes being a somebody? And He was the most ordinary human being I've ever met. And it was extraordinary at the same time. So after that, we never, during this short visit in the library, there were no words exchanged. And I was so surprised to look at him and see how well he looked, how healthy, beaming. And I remember thinking, wow, Osho, you were just so sick a day or two ago, and now you look so beautiful. And he could read my mind. He just smiled when I had that thought. And he just turned and walked away through the veranda doors. And that was it.
Okay, well, thank you so much for telling us this amazing, intimate moment and this meeting, accidental meeting, if you like, with Osho. And clearly still has a strong impact on you. It's lovely to have it here on record. So I have three final questions. The first one is, what's your morning routine? How does your morning look like in the first couple of hours of your day?
Very simple. I'm addicted to one cup of coffee every morning, and that's the only one I have. But I love that one cup of coffee. So my routine is get out of bed, stagger into the kitchen, make a cup of coffee, stagger back to bed, and just enjoy drinking a cup of coffee. And that's all. That's it.
Okay, that's a wonderful way to start the day, for sure. The second question is, what's your favorite meditation and why?
One is the Atisha meditation that I heard Osho speak about. In one, where you breathe in the suffering of everyone or anyone and breathe out into your heart, and then it transform it into love and light and breathe that out back. And that I'm doing a lot more than usual because here we are in this pandemic. The other one is just what I heard Osho speak about in Puna One, which is watching, be present, be aware, everything that you do, taking a shower, eating food, walking to the canteen, whatever you're doing. That really resonated with me. And I think that was the first meditation that really stuck with me because I could do it anywhere. I didn't have to go to Buddha Hall and do it. I didn't have to go anywhere and do it. I didn't have to sit down to do it. It was always available. Just be present. Yeah.
Okay. So the last question is, you live the Osho experiment. What does it mean to you personally to be with Osho today?
I knew you were going to ask me that, but I actually don't have an answer. It is so private and so internal. I find it almost impossible to talk about because basically I don't know how to answer that.
Okay, no, I think it's also very meaningful and significant that somehow you are at a loss of words to express your connection with Osho today, because after all this interview it's clear that you are deeply connected and Osho had a huge impact, and you know, your love for Osho is so clear and evident. So I really take it as something that is so special for you, so intimate, that words cannot render justice to what you feel towards Osho.
Mm. I actually don't speak of him hardly to anyone. I mean, it's unless somebody is really receptive, I don't speak about any of it. The ashram, Pune, Osho, Russia. It's just very private somehow. It's become very private.
So that makes it even more beautiful. And I really appreciate you taking the time to share your story with Osho today, with us at Love Osho Podcast, and to make it available for all the Osho lovers. And it's so amazing. And so thank you so much, Jalad. I really appreciate what you've done and for opening your heart. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Swaron. I love the Love Osho podcast. Thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you. Lots of love and a big hug.
Okay. Big hug to you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it and leave a review. Visit loveoshow.com for more episodes, blogs, or to connect with us.